Tornadoes in December. Go figure.
It's showtime.
It most assuredly is. This is The Horn. It is the 13th day of December, 2021. Hi, I'm Robin. It is Morin Monday here, of course, and the countdown is on for Annette and I leaving this place. I have a doctor's appointment on Wednesday, and hopefully I get the go code then to begin the slow process of us heading up the road and eventually winding up in the fastness of our mountains. But like I said, imagine tornadoes, December. And not just any tornadoes. Like F3, F5, maybe. It may wind up being an F5, the first since 2013. But before we get into all of that, every program here at The Horn begins with gratitude, and this program is no different. So with that in mind, thanks go out to our subscribers for the 13th, 12th, and 11th day of the month. And what that entails is thank you to Gary and Gaia. Thank you so much. And thank you so much to our dear sister Jude. And thank you as well to Gary up in New York. Thank you to Paul. Thank you, Paul, so much. And thanks as well to John and Paul from Parts Unknown and Christopher in Oregon. And thank you to Tony and Chico. Thank you all so much for being partial sponsors of the program and helping to keep all of this on the air and all the sticks holding all the spinning plates and everything that goes into keeping this program on the air for almost two decades. It is genuinely appreciated, not just by me, not just by Annette, but by the whole Horn Family Community Congregation, because, you know, there's nothing for sale here. No, there's no charge for access to the stream or anything like that, or the podcasts or anything. It's all just a matter of the voluntary gifting of the members of the community who like to see this continue to go on, and it does. It means so very much to so many people. I get the notes all the time saying what the Horn means to them, and I cannot thank you enough. Those of you who keep the program going, thank you. Now, with that having been said, the fundraising goal, well, it stands at $1,340. And hopefully we can knock that down some, a little bit at a time, a little bit at a time, a little bit at a time, until we have, eliminated some of the backlog. And that is just so very important because, as I think about us, you know, getting back toward home, well, there's a lot that goes into that. But like I said, I have what I think, if everything plays out as I hope it will, I'll have my last follow-up appointment with my surgeon this Wednesday, and hopefully he will then say, yeah, sure, you know, just be careful, don't try to push it too hard, and begin making your way home. And then after that, I'll probably have to make another road trip down here sometime in early February for my 3-month follow-up and sometime in March for my 6. But those won't be, you know, weeks or months on end. That's just a down and back, and there we are. Over the weekend, as hell yawned open in the Midwest and the Southeast and South Central, of the United States, I couldn't help remembering, it was about this time, 2019, and I was by myself. I was in Florence when I was down there to do the play. It's up there from here. And I stayed on the phone with Annette the whole time, and me and a little stuffed squirrel hunkered down in a bathtub while the tornado warning sirens wailed there in Northwest Alabama. In December, again, did I mention it was December? Because May and June are, and you know, to a certain extent, March, April, May, June, those are your big tornado months here in the tornado belt. Because things start warming up and the cold air comes down and it makes us, when it starts the cyclonic process. And the next thing you know, the sirens are going off and you're in a bathtub in an apartment complex. And I stayed on the phone with Annette, and I remember telling her, yeah, because of the fixtures in the bathtub, I said, I'm trying to figure out if I want to be, if I want to have the faucet shot through me from the front, or me drip impaled on them from the back, because it was a hell of a choice, because it wasn't a long enough tub for me to lay down, but it, no, and there was no, they couldn't get a mattress or anything, nothing, so I just had a big blanket. But it struck me as odd, and I think we even talked about it on air back then. It struck me as odd to be hunkering down from a tornado warning in December, right? Yeah. And that all came rushing back to me over the weekend when, once again, it's December. And I knew on like Saturday that things were, it might be kind of craptastic, because Friday and into Saturday, it wasn't just warm, it was balmy and it was humid. And it was, to say the very least, unseasonable. So, and then what happened. And my God, the horror. The idea, and I guess this hadn't been registered anything like it since 1925. But the idea that a tornado would form up, touch down, and stay touched down, like just a chainsaw running through the land for 200 flipping miles. Oh my God. And just chew up everything in its path. The photos I've seen that I know you've seen look like a bomb went off or like a bombing campaign. And some places, because of the pressure issues and everything, some places literally blew up. Poor Mayfield, Kentucky, and over in Illinois and Arkansas and Tennessee. I mean, there are towns that just don't exist anymore. And by way of mentioning, the reason I mention that is because we have to understand these things as not freak accidents of nature. They aren't. They are not accidents. They are the direct and proximate results of things, of processes that we as human beings have been putting in motion since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And let's make something abundantly clear. That 200-mile-long path of destruction is not just a 200-mile-long path of tornadic destruction. That is a 200-mile-long path of conservatism. It's a 200-mile-long path of republicanism. It's a 200-mile-long path of Reaganism. You remember when that greasy-headed old B-movie actor, old 666 himself, Ronald Wilson Reagan, as one of the first acts of his presidency upon taking office in 1981, was to take down the solar panels from the roof of the White House as a wink and a nod to the oil and coal and gas industries that, well, there was a new sheriff in town and he was coated in crude and coal dust. Well, this is what comes of it. This is what comes of a jackass senator from Oklahoma who famously took a snowball into the well of the Senate and declaimed about the fact that climate change was a hoax because it snowed in Washington, D.C. in freaking January. This is that. There are definable points along the line such that, you know, we can know that our over-reliance on fossil fuels has heated up the planet. And thanks to News Ninja Gene, I was reading a science article earlier today, beginning in the late 1800s, a Swedish scientist named Aarhus, I think his name was Aarhus. Sorry, stupid Scandinavian accent. I apologize. Said, yeah, it's possible for human activity to warm the atmosphere. And so here we are. And it is so, so frustrating because this is an intersection between politics and the everyday lives of everyday people. I say this ironically. I love it when people say, well, you know, I ain't really that interested in politics. Baby, politics is interested in you. And it's going to touch you whether you're interested in it or not. It's going to touch you whether or not, no matter how many hours you sit staring at the TV screen and Fox News TV, Radio Rwanda, shrieking about how Kamala Harris or Joe Biden quietly snuck in and impersonated a man with behavioral health disorders and set fire to the Fox Christmas tree. Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how long you sit there watching the babbling fools of Newsmuck and Fox and Onan, the network that spills its news upon the ground, grunting and barking and hooting about critical race theory and making our poor little white children feel real bad about the whiteness fellow cells. It doesn't matter. This matters. There are tens of thousands of people in primarily in Kentucky, but elsewhere as well. No water, no sewage, no electricity, no gas. And up in that neck of the woods, it's the overnight lows are dropping below freezing now. The Democratic governor of Kentucky has said that no one will go unhoused during this crisis, and is opening up state parks and lodges to provide shelter for people who have been unhomed as a result of this disaster. I mean, there's always been, in this neck of the woods and on this continent, there have always been tornadoes. But, not this bad. Not anywhere near this bad or this frequent. You know, the last F5 tornado was 2013, and it hit in May. So we should probably bear that in mind. But I'm getting a bit ahead of myself. I want to check in with Joey. Subject line: lockout. It was on this day in 2000 that Al Gore was basically locked out of the White House as George W. Bush, dim leader, claimed the presidency a day after the U.S. Supreme Court shut down further recounts of disputed ballots in Florida. Jeffrey recalls the voting recall. Al Gore conceded, delivering the most insincere, cowardly bullshit speech ever uttered, as he made a call for unity instead of making a call to continue to count the votes in Florida. Fuck Al Gore. Gore should have never conceded and continued to insist that Florida recount all of its votes. Hell, the asshole Donald J. Trump sent his lawyers to court 60 different times to contest his legitimate loss, and Al Gore could not be bothered to send even one legal liaison to challenge the supreme travesty. Gore should have continued campaigning and protesting in every major Florida city just to demonstrate the disgusting display of the politicized Supreme Court picking the president. And because the Supreme Court installed George W. Bush, full well knowing if all the votes were counted that Bush would have lost, we did not end up with the legitimately elected Al Gore in the White House as president. However, instead, years later, when another illegally installed president landed in the White House thanks to the Russians' supreme courting of Trump, the country ended up with Gore such on the Supreme Court, but no such Gore in the White House. I understand Jeffrey's fury. It was a different time, and a lot of us sat and watched as Al Gore conceded for the good of the nation. And you know, now you've got, if you recall the story from the last couple of weeks, now you've got a federal district judge who has remarked from the bench in the prosecution of one of the insurrectionists that Al Gore conceded gracefully and with an eye toward the well-being of the nation when he had a hell of a lot better reason to raise a ruckus than Nitwit Nero ever has or ever will. no small amount of irony in that. Of course, when it comes to the recount, and when it comes to the 2000 election, I place every last bit of blame on one person. Sandra Day O'Connor. She knew what the right answer was. She even admitted as much. But she put politics ahead of the well-being of her country. And she voted with a group of judicial thugs on the tissue paper thin fraud of a lie that this was a one-off and Bush v. Gore would never be relied upon as precedent, should not be relied upon as precedent. Well, coulda, shoulda, woulda in the Supreme Court, as we have recently found out, much to our chagrin and dismay, is a load of crap. It really, really is. And so Sandra Day O'Connor could have created the five justice majority to shut down George W. Bush's pissant whining and told Florida, count all the damn votes. Count them all. But she didn't. And hopefully, it won't be, but on her tombstone, it should read Sandra Day O'Connor fucked America. Because she did. I think of the 3,000 people dead on September 11th, 2001. And the fact that had Al Gore been president, that probably would not have happened. I think about the countless dead. The Iraqi civilians and Afghani civilians. Who would not have been saved for what Sandra Day O'Connor did. I think about the American service personnel dead in forever wars in Iraq and Afghanistan who would not have been had it not been for Sandra Day O'Connor. We focus our ire and our wrath upon George W. Bush and Richard B. Dick Cheney before he dicks you. But she goes largely unnoticed. But anyway, as for the people of Maysville, Kentucky, Joey writes, and your candle factory that got blown away by a massive tornado not seen in nearly 100 years. Oh, God, Jeffrey's burning over this one. Well, you all down there in Kentucky just seem to love to tempt fate, don't you? First of all, most of you morons on this Moron Monday deny that guns kill people, as you believe everybody, including newborn babies, should have their own assault rifle. Most of you dumbasses deny that COVID actually exists, and the ones who do believe it does exist would rather shove something up your ass instead of getting vaccinated. Finally, you fools deny climate change, even though a 200-mile twister just blew the living shit out of your town, but you continue to vote for climate-denying people like Moscow Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul. The only thing I have to say to you all in places like Maysville is this. When those candles you were making were all lit up, they were a hell of a lot brighter than you were. Let me extend my thoughtless prayers to you, and I'll see if I can have Elton John to come to Kentucky and sing Candle in the Wind at all of your funerals, considering your candle factory just got blown away. Sorry, I, Jeffrey the Giraffe, have no sympathy for the South, as your bullshit is literally killing this country. Oh, Jeffrey. Jeffrey, Jeffrey. It's so sad. There are so many things. I mean, there's truth in what he says. And, of course, you got to remember that Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist and that thing on his head, who voted against, for instance, relief after Hurricane and Superstorm Sandy back in, what, 2012? No, 2013. He voted against that. He's voted against relief for other victims of natural disasters because he's a fiscal conservative and a libertarian. Well, he lickety-split banged out a letter and zipped it off to President Biden saying, you know, we got to have some help here in Kentucky. We need some money. Got to get some money here, lickety-split. And all his fiscal conservatism just went right out the window, as it should have gone out the window long, long before. I mean, it's moments like this that we can see so, so clearly how thoroughly fraudulent and mean-spirited and soulless and gutless and heartless small government conservatism really is. Because if these so-called conservatives had the small government that they'd so desperately yearn for, there would be no FEMA to respond to disasters like this. people would just be left to fend for themselves, and whatever happens, happens. And having been involved in a small disaster, I can tell you that there's a lot of people that are still going to get hung out to dry by FEMA anyway. It took us years to repair damage and replace things that we lost in a derecho in 2012. And FEMA didn't have a goddamn thing to do with it. No help at all. So, you know, I love you, Joey and Giraffe, but I think it's wrong to want people to suffer. I think it's wrong to tell people that you have no sympathy for them. In the moment of disaster, because you know what? Let's point something out, because none of these states are monoliths. You know, I'll say again something that I've said in the past and will continue to say. It ain't easy being progressive or liberal even in a state like Talabama or Kentuckystan or Tennistan. It's not easy. It's not easy for Joey and Giraffe being progressive in Ohio-stan. And there were liberal and progressive lives lost, forever altered, shattered in these tornadoes. None of these towns are bastions of red bleeding. Red-bleeding political sentiment. They've all got Democrats in them. They've all got liberals. And this is the time when we cannot divide along political lines. Because that only makes their case for them. So maybe we pick up and maybe we clean up. And then we have the conversation about, let's not have this happen again. It's just, the horror is too much to... It is almost too much to contemplate. I mean, I've seen the swaths of destruction that tornadoes, but Darlene in Connecticut tells me you're wrong. The tornado touched down and never lifted, meting out its destruction for 227 miles. Yeah, not just 200. Let's not cut Reaganism, conservatism, republicanism, and James Mountain Inhofe and his snowball any slack whatsoever. Yeah, that's his middle name, Mountain. So I guess it was all the LGBTQIA++ folks living in that 227-mile path, right? Hardly. But I'm sure they were touched, too. Devastation knows no gender, knows no sexual orientation, and it acts indiscriminately. You know, the disaster is far too serious to make any sort. So, I mean, one of the and this is actually probably kind of dangerous, but you know, one of the things that came to mind is, you know, if all these conservatives would stop shitting on us, we'd stop sending the tornadoes, because you know that where that comes from. Is that they're the ones who claim that God sends tornadoes because of us, and hurricanes and earthquakes. And I think the mullahs in Iran at one point in time said volcanoes too, which is such unmitigated bullshit. It's just so utterly, absurdly wrong. But to go back Joey and Giraffe. Joey says, I spoke last week of the new CEO of First Energy replacing the former CEO, Chuck Jones, who was fired because of his alleged entanglement with Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder's bribery scandal. Jeffrey Jr. has a thought. Yes, I remember the new CEO's name is Straw, and Joey thinks that name is very appropriate because he's just another straw man, and Joey might know a few things because he used to work at First Energy and casually knew Chuck Jones. And of course, reminder, not the cool Chuck Jones who gave us some of the most brilliant animated comedy ever made. Now, this is an entirely wrong Chuck Jones. Joey says, that's correct, Junior. I met Chuck Jones when he would frequent the facility in West Akron, and I really rather saw him as an aloof character, especially toward the lowly security guards such as me. On this exact day 2 years ago, just 2 weeks before Christmas and only 1 month after the voters bailed out First Energy to the tune of $1.2 billion, thanks to a $60 million bribe by First Energy to Larry Householder, First Energy literally laid off half the guards at the West Akron facility, and I was one of them. I had a very important job at that facility. I was in charge of guarding the gate, which allowed people access to the main control room. This main control looked like something out of NASA, as that room literally controlled the access to people's energy in 7 states, including West Virginia. Only certain people were allowed access through that gate, and they had to have their credentials on them at all times. I was pretty good about only allowing the proper people access to the main control center, and one day, just about a week before Christmas, I was really good about denying access to one certain person. It was a week before Christmas, and there were only a handful of employees at the center when I noticed one peculiar vehicle pull up to the gate. I had a few days left to work at that facility, through no fault of my own. I immediately recognized that it was Chuck Jones's SUV, and I thought I'd have a little fun with this asshole. I simply told him that we were having trouble with the gate and couldn't manage to engage the release switch. This was absolutely not the truth, and I just figured I'd let the bastard sit out there until somebody else needed to enter. Well, nobody came for nearly an hour, and I mischievously locked out the CEO of a major corporation for approximately an hour. When he came in and asked me if I knew what I was doing, I turned the tables on him and asked why the CEO of his company would lay off 8 people right before Christmas after the taxpayers just bailed the company out. I didn't wait for his answers. During that hour while he was waiting for the gate to open, I'd packed up all my stuff and was ready to walk out the door, and I did just that after I glared at CEO Jones. I'd already landed another job with a security company, and I just figured the current firm would call and let me go after the incident, but much to my surprise, not even one word was mentioned of my sudden departure and a confrontation with the CEO. Less than 2 weeks later, in January 2020, I began working at Gojo, as many of you know. Jeffrey concludes, sometimes you just got to fight the power, especially at the power company. So this has been Joey's Journal for More and Monday, the 13th of December, with Giraffe singing the old Isley Brothers tune, Fight the Power. And so there is a Fight the Power $50 challenge on the table. Thank you, Joey, and thank you, Giraffe. I appreciate all you do, and I appreciate all the other things you do as well. Fight the power, indeed. As to Gore's concession, Steve in New York says, in 2000, we hadn't seen a situation where the person elected president didn't win the popular vote. We hadn't seen one of those for 112 years. It's happened twice in the last 20 years, Bush and Trump. I don't know if he thought this, but I suspect given those 112 years between the last time that happened in 2000, it's reasonable Gore thought that this was an anomaly and wouldn't happen again into the very distant future. That's entirely possible. I don't hate. I don't hate Al Gore. I don't. I get sad when I think about Al Gore, because I get sad for all the families who got destroyed, and all the families that were shattered, and all the lives that were wasted. Because a gang of political thugs. Remember the Brooks Brothers riot? I do. Descended on South Florida, and oddly enough, some of those were the very same people we see continue to wreak mayhem in our politics to this day. I think Roger Stone was part of that, wasn't he? Yeah, yeah. By the way, Joey's Journal, Billable Rick says, how about some virtual cowbells for these gems from Joey's Journal today? This country ended up with Gore Such on the Supreme Court, but no such Gore in the White House. I thought that was brilliant, too. And also, let me extend my thoughtless prayers to you. and a double virtual cowbell for Joey mischievously locking out CEO Chuck Jones of First Energy for an hour. Yeah, I love that. That's absolutely brilliant. And somehow or another, because Chuck Jones, I keep seeing it in my mind's eye as maybe a cell from an animated Warner Brothers short, where Chuck Jones is perhaps playing, Elmer Fudd, and Joey is decidedly Bugs Bunny. What Darlene said about 227 miles to that, add to that, I heard 250 miles from several sources, says Jeremy in Vermont. Cynthia in the Bay Area with an observation says, and by the way, where the hell was Jesus when those tornadoes touched down and plowed through all those people? What are they praying for and contributing all that money to if Jesus isn't going to protect them in the first place? Oh, right. There's no Jesus. But they'll still be praying to Jesus and asking for thoughts and prayers when they really need rescue workers, equipment, and money. Well, and by the way, maybe besides sending rescue workers, equipment, supplies, and money, as Biden is doing, he should go down there and toss them some paper towels, just like Trump did in Puerto Rico. God, Lord. Yeah, let's don't say we didn't. Can you imagine? No, don't even. Don't even imagine what this would have been like had Nitwit Nero still been in the Oval Office. Although I have no doubt that there will be a press release at some point, if there hasn't already, maybe I missed it, blaming the entire tornado on Joe Biden. Yeah. Would any of us be surprised? Thank you, Cynthia. Thank you so much. Jude noting, it's so good to hear from Darlene. Both Kevin in Colorado Springs and I have missed hearing her and wondered if all was well with her end of the world. And Ron in Raleigh reminds us of the Brooks Brothers riot. Don't forget that Brat Beer Bong Kavanaugh was there, and so was Stephen Miller. Yeah. Round up the usual suspects, shall we? Right. So I hope. Oh, and by the way, there's another challenge on the table. There's a fight the power challenge, courtesy of Joey and Giraffe. And there's another challenge, courtesy of Brother Deacon Asa. Because we passed another grim milestone. 800,000 Americans are now dead from COVID. The Trump pandemic, the COVID Caligula plague, 800,000 Americans. And tucked away within that statistic is another horror, a horror within a horror. We now know that the pandemic has claimed the life of one in every 100 Americans aged 65 or older. Now, we all know that I'm no ciphering whiz, but I'm pretty sure that means that the pandemic has killed 1% of the Medicare-aged population of this country. 65. Used to be that was retirement age, but not anymore, because small government conservatism and Tip O'Neill and Ronnie Reagan took off their jackets and rolled their sleeves up, and Chris Matthews probably gets another little tingle down his pants every time he thinks about that, and got to work and fuck the American people. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 1986, I believe it was. Was it not? The pandemic is on the rise again. And so, since January 1st, Brother Deacon Asa informed me, 8 out of 10 COVID deaths in this country have been from what we refer to as the South. Alabama, West Virginia, and Oklahoma are the top three in per capita deaths. As Brother Deacon Asa says, you're batting 2 out of 3 there, friend. That's a 666, a horrifying batting average. 666? Really? Yes. Why don't you look into a vacation property in the Oklahoma end of the Ozarks? That'd make a perfect trifecta. To which I responded, this ain't plague bingo. And so Brother Deacon Asa put a $25 plague bingo challenge on the table. So there's $75 in challenges on the table. And if those were met, we'd get down to $1,190 for our fundraising goal, and be halfway toward at least one of last week's day's funding. It really would be nice if we could get something close to caught up. Where's Jesus? Asks Matt in San Francisco. Apparently, Jesus is in the bathtub making business. I heard of a few stories of people riding out the storm in their bathtubs. Thank you, Jesus, for a storm-resistant bathtub. Yeah, Jesus just left Chicago. Never a bad time for a ZZ Top reference. Meanwhile, Randy Radar says, Jesus was the homeless guy in Kentucky who left town just before the tornadoes hit. Jeremy pointing out COVID in America as of last week, we also crossed another not so small death toll. The total killed in our actual shooting war, the Civil War, both sides in 5 years of trading lead and cannonballs. Mm-hmm. And I guess you could say that this is a variation on the theme, isn't it, Jerry? COVID killing seniors. Lee in New York says, see, the Trumpanzees want Social Security to be able to continue sending checks to the survivors. Yeah, it's almost as though it became some sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. Remember when Dan Patrick, the lieutenant governor of Texas, otherwise known as Saudi Arabia, thank you, Joy, for reminding me of that, said that our seniors need to drop dead for the sake of the economy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Stephen New York points out, subject line, Kentucky, I won't kid you. When this disaster happened in the good Commonwealth, all I could think of was this listing of things. Had this happened anywhere in a blue state, we would hear the shit about God's wrath because of the gays. We would hear about no aid unless it was paid for somewhere by cuts somewhere else. I think what it boils down to is this. My mind says, fuck them. My heart says, give them anything they need. And this is one of those moments where the heart has to win. Nothing would have necessarily stopped these things, but we have had a chance over the last couple of generations to slow them. December, what is very possibly going to wind up an F5 tornado in December. Oh, these things just happen. No, these things don't just happen. Don in West Tennistan says that tornado was just 25 miles north of me, and a friend of mine worked at the candle factory. He's out of a job, but thankfully has his life. I'm glad, Don, and I'm glad you're safe. So glad. So very glad. Thanks for checking in and letting us know you're okay. That may not have been your primary point, but it at least provides a certain amount of comfort because you are a long-standing and dear member of this, our little community. Brother Deacon A says, it's actually a 200-mile path of freedom. And by God, when Governor Bevin is reinstated, we'll change it from Mayfield, Kentucky to freedom, freedom, Kentucky. Hashtag sink the ship to own the libs. I know. And see, when we eventually start making, and it's really kind of odd because I've mentioned over the past couple of weeks, when we start making our way home, We will do so leaving Florence. And because, you know, we could just leave Birmingham and go straight up the spine of the Appalachians, or just to the west of the Allegheny front. I don't like that route. And I just feel this need. And it's a heart need. It's not an intellectual need. I can't stand the idea of being down here without going back and spending a couple of days in my hometown. It's all tied in with why I did what I did, where I did it. I was born in this state, and I wanted to be reborn here. I wanted to try to, in some way that's entirely emotional and not intellectual at all, erase some of the stain of grief from my mother having died here at the hospital, the same hospital that did my surgery, where her surgery was botched. And a little bit of, just a little bit of the same, one of the same substances they used on me might have saved her life. I guess that doctor's retired by now. And I guess the other doctor who ignored her for way too long before recommending surgery, I guess he's dead too, referring her for surgery. And so I feel a need to go to the cemetery and have a little chat. Can't stand being down here and not going to. It's one of those weird human hang-ups. And leaving Florence, we would take a route that goes up into Tennessee, up I-65 through Nash Vegas, and cross into Kentucky, a little past Gallatin and Portland, Tennessee, and eventually, I thought, you know, a good stopping place would be Bowling Green. I don't know if there'll be a hotel available. They may be full of people who are unhoused by the tornadoes, because apparently the tornadoes whacked the shit out of Bowling Green too. And basically, it could very well be a terrible mess all the way until we start turning east and heading out of the bluegrass in Kentucky and into Appalachia. And that's Lexington. So I may have to rethink the route. May wind up going the Knoxville route, the Chattanooga Knoxville route after all. The mileage is about the same. I just find the drive more pleasant. So all of that, I can, if everything goes well on the 15th at my appointment, then the plan will be to leave here on the 21st, spend a little time in Florence, and then head home and take as long as we need. And be home well before New Year's, because I want us to have a New Year's Eve show. A New Year's Eve Friday on the front, or New Year's Eve on the front porch. What day is New Year's Eve? Let's check that out. Well, how about that? New Year's Eve will be a Friday on the front porch. So that's pretty wild. Sympathy for them, Leah New York says, it's hard to have sympathy for people who thank God for surviving a natural disaster that kills many of their church congregants. And when COVID kills their neighbors, they praise Jesus for ivermectin. Next is how much they hate government. It's hard to love people who hate people. I understand that sentiment, Lee, but if you read, for instance, Plato's Symposium, you will find you'll find Socrates arguing that to love someone who hates you is actually the highest form of love. And of course, he said that long, long before the same sentiment was echoed by Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and semi-literate itinerant rabbi who wore a dress every day of their life. And probably even predates, I'm not quite sure what the dating is. It might actually predate Hillel. It could be that Hillel picked up the idea from Socrates during the Hellenistic period in Palestine when the armies of Alexander basically seized control of the region from Persia. Fascinating, isn't it? History. Yeah. Lee adds, I hope you get good news on the Ides of December. Not everyone is Caesar. And not every Ides is the Ides of March either, Lee. So, yeah, I appreciate you. I really, really do. But this being more in Monday, oh, and shame on me, I haven't logged into the... I think I'm in the chat room. Let's see, and we turn the sound off. Good. And it looks like a really good group in the chat room, if you'd like to pop by. Mm-hmm. If you wander over right this very minute, you'll be greeted by Anatole and Otto DeShot and Roger in Oregon and Squeaky and Stockton Larry and Timo, and capably moderated by both longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky and his more than capable assistant, pinch hit midweek chat room utility moderator and all-around great guy, Brother Bishop Steve from Georgistan. Maybe pop on by. But the tornado and the human suffering, are not all that we have in terms of news of the day, especially when it comes to Morans. Very much so. Morans everywhere. Some news out of the University of Florida, since we were also talking about COVID. The University of Florida has launched a formal investigation because of an internal report that came to light. It turns out that somebody in Florida state government, Ron DeSantis, has been putting pressure on researchers at the University of Florida there in Gainesville to either delay or preferably destroy COVID-19 research data before it could reach publication status. The vice president of University of Florida Research is a man named David Norton. And this past Friday morning, he issued an email to faculty and staff and announced the basic results of the investigation, saying UF Research became aware of possible violations of the UF policy on research integrity to the reported destruction of COVID-19 research data at the University of Florida. Yeah. naturally, the committee there didn't name names, because the people who had their research either delayed or destroyed would probably have their careers also destroyed if Rona death sentence, the illegitimate white supremacist adjacent governor of Florida, got wind of their of who they are. Dr. Danaya Wright, one of the faculty professors at UF, and one of the six authors of the report, said, "I don't know that we need a smoking gun in particular to say that this is coming from state government, governmental entities. There was external pressure to destroy de-identified data, barriers to accessing and analyzing de-identified data in a timely manner, and barriers to publication of scientific research. And faculty, as a result, faced challenges in trying to contribute scientific findings during the pandemic because, of course, Governor Rona death sentence, who had a spokes creep naturally issue a statement. Governor DeSantis does not interfere. I'm sorry, that's Jeffrey's voice, isn't it? Well, you'll have these things. Governor DeSantis does not interfere with the internal matters at UF, which this is. Nobody from our office has told UF professors to refrain from criticizing any state policies." That was state spokes creep Christina Pushaw. Really? Really? Thank you, Goddess of Irony. I'm going to have to rifle through my remaining stock of rubber chickens and sacrifice one to you at midnight tonight. A spokesflack, a spokes creep for Ron DeSantis named Christina Pushaw. Pushaw. Huzzah. Huzzah. Pushaw. Among other things, three University of Florida full-time professors were muzzled, silenced, banned from being able to testify as paid experts in a lawsuit that was brought against the state over, what? Voting rights. Yeah. Huh. How about that? Now, there is no official confirmation that COVID-19 data has been destroyed, but will anyone be surprised? I guess that's the biggest question. Imagine a country, and it's hard not to say that such a country is a country in decline, that is afraid of intellectual rigor and scientific inquiry. But that's us. That's us. Not all of us, just some of us. But I say imagine that as though there was something surprising about it. Mm-mm, no, there isn't. Not at all. Because we started out talking about how generations of climate science have been denied, have been obfuscated, have been quashed, and that's how you wind up with the weekend that we just had. We have a scientific community that put people on the moon, that has done amazing things in technology. By the way, Time Magazine has named Elon Musk as their person of the year. Now, we must, of course, remember that Time Magazine's person of the year does not necessarily mean that the person is good. At one point in time, that little monster who had the Charlie Chaplin mustache and started a war that killed tens of millions of human beings, at one point in time, he was Time's, back then, man of the year. Yeah. And Elon Musk is the person of the year this year, I guess, for being a rich dude who wants to create space tourism. At least that's the cover story. you know, by the time he's 90 or whatever, he'll probably be trying to mine the asteroids. Didn't he say something about wanting to do all of our hydrocarbon production in space or something equally stupid about like that? And as far as Bowling Green, Kentucky is concerned, going back a couple of minutes, Brother Deacon Asa said, not to mention the large crowds that descend onto Bowling Green for the annual Bowling Green Massacre reenactment celebration right about this time of year. The hotels and motels and hookers will be stuffed full. God, Brother Deacon, only you, only you. Yeah, who could forget the horrors of the Bowling Green Massacre? I know, I know. A little bit of what looks like might be good news, dare we think it? What's the right wing like to call them when they don't get their way? The 9 unelected black robe judges of the Supreme Court. Well, today, they told some religious goobers to go get fucked. I know, amazing. In two cases, there was a petition for injunctive relief to stop the state of New York from enacting its mandate that some healthcare workers in the state have to be vaccinated against COVID-19. They denied requests for emergency injunctive relief for religious exemptions while the litigation continues in the courts below the Supreme Court. Naturally, at least three members of the court had to get it drop-dead wrong. Those were Clarence, Uncle Slappy Pubes on the Coke Can Thomas, and Sammy shoot the black kid in the head at 30 feet, back of the head, and, of course, Ann's boy Neil. They would have granted the injunction so that the Rona could get a real good foothold inside healthcare facilities in the state of New York. But I guess that means that Brat and Amy COVID Barrett might have actually been like the blind hog that finds an acorn now and then and got this one right. Maybe Justice Handmaid asked her daddy, I mean husband, if she could vote to not bump off a few more New Yorkers. You take your victories where you can find them. And Stephen New York described that as the other side of the horse trade on the Texas law. Yeah, they give you the bitter, then they give you a little bit of presumptive. But I don't feel like it's a win that shouldn't have been much of a challenge to be a win. Oh well. Damnedest thing. Even a blind hog, right? So here we are at the top of the hour. And covered a good bit of ground, I feel like. In the future, Randy Radar says, you will read Justice Thomas rules against his own interracial marriage. Oh, given half a chance, I'm sure he would. Probably figure out some way to grandfather the ruling for anybody who has ever made, I don't know, reference to Long Dong Silver or some such. Oh, thank you. Lee, serving as the Horn Ad Hoc Research Department, says, yes, Socrates was before Hillel. Well, doesn't that create an interesting potential timeline? But then again, there's a lot of Socratic stuff in Hillel, and in Yeshua the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and semi-literate itinerant rabbi who wore a dress every day of his life. Mm-hmm. It's going to get... more and more interesting, I think. The heat has been turned up some on Mark Meadows. You may recall Mark Meadows complained bitterly that he didn't want to be Donald Trump's chief of staff, but God had different ideas. Well, now it's being reported that the January 6th Commission already has the goodies. CNN was reporting that earlier today. Mm-hmm. Here's hoping he's not sweating, too. No, here's hoping he's sweating. He's flop sweating. Jamie Gangle at CNN said the House Select Committee has everything it needs to paint a brutal, what he described as a brutal narrative about former President Trump's fit that he threw in response to the insurrection he started. And there are now apparently people who know the people who were emailing Mark Meadows because they couldn't get through to Nitwit Nero as the insurrection was unfolding, describing the lay of the land. Jamie Gangle talked to Jake Tapper earlier today, I believe it was.
Topping our politics lead, just a few short hours from now, former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows will almost certainly be one step closer to being held in criminal contempt of Congress for refusing to testify. The January 6th Select Committee is meeting tonight to vote on a contempt referral for Trump's former White House Chief of Staff. This is the committee reveals new evidence about the deadly Capitol attack, and CNN's Jamie Gangle joins us live. And Jamie, what are your sources telling you about what we can expect tonight?
So I think this is beyond a vote, that we're going to get significant new information. Mark Meadows was in the room on January 6th, and the committee has a lot of the receipts. Jake, a source familiar tells me that among the communications and texts and emails, the committee is going to simply lay out how much was going on in real time. What Meadows knew, who was speaking to him, Republican loyalists, White House officials, and that we're going to see those actual texts. Let me give you an example of two that are in the 51-page document, but they speak to the kind of thing we're going to hear. So this is a former White House employee to Meadows on January 6th in real time during the riot. You guys have to say something. Even if the president's not willing to put out a statement, you should go to the cameras and say, we condemn this, please stand down. If you don't, people are going to die. Now, the committee in the document did not say who that former White House official is, but we actually know who it is, thanks to Washington Post reporters Carol Lenig and Phil Rucker in their book, I Alone Can Fix It, identified that as Alyssa Farah, who was a former strategic communications director. Another example, we're told that we're going to hear about text exchanges from media personalities. That sounds to me like reporters, maybe some Fox News reporters who are reaching out to Mark Meadows. And I think we will hear tonight about a Trump family member who texts Mark Meadows. And here is the quote from the report. It says, indicating that Mr. Meadows is, quote, pushing hard, end quote, for a statement from President Trump to, quote, condemn this shit, end quote, happening at the Capitol. At the end of tonight, I think it's going to be very clear that no one can pretend this wasn't a big deal, because these are Trump loyalists, Republican members of Congress, Trump administration officials.
Yeah, I mean, it was an attempted coup, an attempted overthrow of the government. Why does Meadows seem to be fighting this testimony that they want him to provide so hard, given the fact that he initially volunteered much of this information?
Correct. So his lawyer keeps saying it's about executive privilege. It's very hard to argue executive privilege when you're handing these things over. I think there are two things that are pretty clear to the committee. One is that Donald Trump does not want Meadows to testify. It may also be that Meadows, being in the room, may be concerned that instead of saying executive privilege, he may have to take the fifth.
Yeah, well, I mean, he has a book out, right?
Correct.
He's trying to sell a book. He handed over all this information. He's doing interviews on MAGA media. It's hard to argue that he has been respecting executive privilege himself.
Correct. And five people died that day. And he.
So things should be getting pretty interesting. And in point of fact, that House meeting will convene, if I understand correctly, that House committee meeting will convene at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And it should be quite the popcorn moment, if one can describe the deadly serious business of American constitutional governance's very future as being something over which one would pop popcorn. Yeah. So just a reminder, there's $75 worth of challenges on the table. The Fight the Power Challenge from Joe and Giraffe and the Plague Bingo Challenge, Jesus, Brother Deacon, from Brother Deacon Asa. And it would be wonderful if we could get a response to some of that. TV people, Stephen New York asks, I'm guessing Hannity, Tucker Carlson, Maria Bartiromo. Yeah, it's not Alex Jones. My money's on Hannity. You've got to get him to stop this shit. Sounds very Hannity. Tucker Carlson was probably enjoying it just way, way, way too much. Like I said, I've filibustered the first hour. And sitting is proving rather excessively difficult this evening for some reason. Maybe because I was, I tested myself yesterday. I did. You can see the pictures on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. And I deliberately, you know, got up, got dressed, did everything I needed to go out. And then I went up, I had a good grocery list, and I went over to the Wiggling Pig, which is, you know, probably not even a mile from me, and went through the store, did all my shopping, and I've been talking for at least 2 weeks about making oxtail soup. And I just wanted to see, you know, I wanted to see how much endurance I had. And so I did not spend any time reclining or resting. I was pretty much on my feet all day yesterday. Just like I said, I wanted to see how far I could go. And I held up pretty well. And I am proud to say, and Annette's here, where I've got things set up. I'm proud to say that oxtail soup came out something fantastic. It's fairly rare. It's fairly that she says good things about my cooking.
Really?
Well, I named them off. My ribs, my salmon, and now this. And you went wild over this.
You are the only person I've ever seen serve borscht at a birthday, okay? So, yeah, I don't know.
But well,
oxtail soup is awesome.
Yeah, I had about seven hunks of oxtail. And Lord, I got the, instead of just using oil for searing them, rendered a few pieces of bacon and had that for flavor in there too. And nothing but salt and pepper on the oxtails, and seared them till they had this beautiful, beautiful crust on all the sides. And then took them out and sauteed the onions and the celery. When that was done, added a can of petite diced tomatoes and some tarragon and shallots and parsley. And about 6 cups of beef broth, and let that and got that all worked together. Then put the oxtails back in, and let the whole thing just simmer low and slow for about 3 hours. And at the 3 hour mark, I put in some tiny little red and Yukon Gold potatoes and some sliced carrots. And let it go for about another half hour more. And I'm proud to say that Annette all day long has said, "That's delicious." And we had it for dinner last night. This morning, I thought it would be interesting to have it over grits. And it was fantastic. I mean, you want to talk about a rib sticking breakfast? Woo! It was amazing over grits this morning. I think maybe tomorrow I might even make a little omelet and have it with an omelet. I mean, it is filling and wonderful. And I don't know if Todd's listening, but if he is, Todd, you got to do this. This is, whew, man, this was some kind of good. And in fact, so does this go into the regular rotation when we get home? And she said, "Oh, absolutely." Made a good size, not a saucepan. Next step up from a saucepan, not quite a stock pot, but it filled it up. And the thing is, those oxtails have all that lovely gelatin tucked away within them, and they. That melted, and so it made the soup part just wonderfully thick and silky and beautiful. Yes, as a matter of fact, I did oxtail soup, and it was, I didn't do any of the stuff with like the West Indian spices, like the allspice and stuff. I just wanted a really rich, hearty, warming comfort food. And oh my God, nice little splash of red wine and a little bit of Worcestershire sauce. And it all just combined exquisitely. And, had it with some of the sourdough toast from Publix, and just magnificent. Thank you, Steve in New York, for getting us started on the challenges. Thank you very kindly. We are now on our way, and there's $65 left to go on the two challenges, the Fight the Power Challenge and the COVID plague bingo challenge. Brendan just jumped in and helped too. And so that means there's $50 to go. So I guess we can say the plague bingo challenge has been met, and I don't have to move to Oklahoma. So thank you for that, Brother Deacon. And thank you for that, Brendan and Steve. That's really, really helpful. Whatever we can do to keep things, keep things above water. I can't wait to get home to my my messy little, probably very cold studio, because it's just, I'm more comfortable there. There's something about, you know, being in an apartment and sharing walls with people, and at least when I get into a shout and scream and frenzy at home, I don't have to worry about, you know, who's hearing me carry on, because people have a right to the quiet enjoyment of their place. And that's why I've tried to keep myself to a relatively low key in that regard. So that having been said, I presume we will all be tuning in at 7 p.m. Eastern Time for the committee meeting. And out of all of the horror and the misery that the tornadoes occasioned this weekend, and the focus of a lot of the reporting, at least early on, has been the candle factory. Joey referenced it. And when I was trying to just see what the for-profit media were talking about today, it was nothing but tornadoes. Well, apparently that candle factory, which has been now leveled and put God knows how many people out of work, well, there was more than meets the eye going on with that story. And it's really disgusting. It's infuriating. NBC News broke the story that as the weather was turning and as people were learning of just how horrifying this storm system was, some of them who were working at the candle factory said that they wanted to try to get home to their loved ones, see to the needs of their family, be with them as this horror bore down upon them. And what's being referred to as the candle factory is actually the Mayfield Consumer Products Factory. And even as the tornado sirens were beginning to wail in Mayfield, Kentucky, NBC News reports, for hours as word of the coming storm spread, as many as 15 workers beseeched managers to let them take shelter at their own homes, only to have the boss tell them no. No. And fearing for their safety, some of them left nonetheless. The bosses told them that if they left, they would be fired. One of the people that happened to was a 21-year-old woman named Michaela Emery. She was injured in the factory when it got blown to kingdom come. And she was a direct witness to bosses talking about firing people who went home to not be in the tornado in the factory. Once she heard one supervisor say, "Oh, if you leave, you're more than likely to be fired." She said, "I heard that with my own ears." I'm guessing, maybe I'm wrong here, I'm guessing that wasn't a union shop. Because see, if you're a union shop and a deadly tornado's bearing down on you, and you need to get home to be with your loved ones, having a union job means that the bosses probably can't say, "Well, you're going to be fired." Dude, how are you going to fire me if I'm dead when this place gets blown away? I'm sure you've seen the footage of the place now. There's no candle factory. There's no consumer products factory. Oh, hell no. I saw an interview with one woman whose, it was her 40th birthday, and she was in the darkness and the rubble and started broadcasting live on Facebook and did what she could to try to keep her coworker's spirits up. She survived. And in the aftermath of this thing, as the cleanup begins, there needs to be a different kind of cleanup. Those supervisors need to be found. Those supervisors need to not have jobs anymore. They're probably trying to put their lives together too. But there should be consequences for what they did to those workers. And it needs to go all the way to the top. You know, some mid-level supervisor doesn't make policy. That comes from the boardroom, or that comes from the CEO. Probably somebody not even on site, probably someone not even affected by the tornadoes. This is the corporate culture that places like the Harvard Business School have created. This is, you know, long dead Milton Friedman, the University of Chicago economist, once said that it was critically important that working people be kept in a constant state of fear of losing their jobs and their worlds collapsing around them if they did. Well, this is, okay, so it's not just the Harvard School of Business, it's also the University of Chicago. Because when workers have dignity, when workers have job security, when they have a union to step up for them and stand together, the profit seekers don't have the life and death power of God Almighty to keep employees in a state of perpetual terror. I mean, explain to me, just as we noted that the tornadoes themselves were a path of destruction wrought by conservatism, explain to me how telling someone who's afraid they will never see their loved ones again because they're not allowed to go home, how is that not some form of economic terrorism? How do you make the argument that it isn't? I'm sort of at a loss. It almost feels like in a civilized country, that would actually be what? A crime? That you could be prosecuted for that kind of behavior? Thank you very kindly to our dear friend Christopher. Christopher said, let's meet these challenges. Much appreciated. So we've got $40 to go now on the Fight the Power Challenge. Thank you, Christopher. Note coming in. From Dave and the Blind, and maybe they're just chatting around down there at the Emporium. It's all Greek, the Jesus, Dave says. Greek-speaking Jewish writers wrote the Gospels. Well, we think that the Gospels probably began in Aramaic, but there is no remainder of that to point to. But certainly, when they were committed to text, it was in what we know as Koine Greek, which is a sort of lower, more vernacular form than, say, a classical Homeric Greek. But no, speaking of going to jail, a development today in the Larry Nassar case. You remember Larry. Larry's the guy who who sexually abused and sexually assaulted. God alone knows how many athletes, particularly those on the U.S. women's gymnastics team. And women's gymnastics is a euphemism because those were like 15-year-old girls. Well, some of his victims reached a settlement that was announced. And it seems, frankly, kind of paltry. $380 million will be paid. USA Gymnastics, the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee, and their insurers will pay out the $380 million as some form of weak recompense for these young women, these girls, having had their a portion of their lives stolen from them. The Wall Street Journal said, well, you know, it's one of the largest settlements ever recorded for victims of sex abuse. It puts an end to the ongoing litigation surrounding Nassar's crimes. And I say that the $380 million may be paltry because there are hundreds of victims. Hundreds. The most well-known among them, Simone Biles, Allie Raceman, Michaela Maroney. And, you know, he didn't just sexually abuse them once. It was repeated. Over and over. Larry Nassar is a sports medicine doctor, you'll recall, at USA Gymnastics and Michigan State University. So if there are hundreds, and if you figure that the lawyers involved are probably going to get some sort of a contingent fee, then being raped repeatedly when the organizations he was working for either knew or should have known may wind up, you know, it may not even be $1 million per victim. Nonetheless, the victims are welcoming the outcome. Rachel Denhollander was the first woman who made all of this public, and she said, this chapter is finally closed. Now the hard work of reform and rebuilding can begin. Whether or not justice comes and change is made depends on what happens next. And one of the curiosities of it all is that it comes in the context of an approval of the settlement. Not by an Article III district judge of the federal court system, but of the federal bankruptcy court system. Because when they found out that they had employed a doctor who had a habit of raping young girls, one of the first things that that USA Gymnastics did was not necessarily to see to the well-being of the girls who'd been raped. It was to see to the well-being of the, come on, fill in the blank, money. And off they ran to the bankruptcy court to file for bankruptcy. To try to limit the financial damage that could be done to the organization. Really? I wish I was kidding. I'm not kidding. I hope there really is something like justice. But the settlement only happened because TIG Insurance Company finally agreed to let go of what is described by the Wall Street Journal as a substantial share of the settlement. The U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee will pay out $34 million. They'll pay off a $6 million loan from the U.S. Olympic Paralympic Committee to USA Gymnastics. And one of the non-financial aspects of the settlement is that one of the victims of the abuse will be on the board of directors of USA Gymnastics. One. Note coming in from Billable Rick. The Kentucky Candle Factory and wrongful death injury lawsuits of any worker who was required to stay in that accursed consumer products factory as the tornado approached lost their lives or were severely injured due to the refusal of supervisors to allow them to flee the building. They have a substantial claim for wrongful death or injury against the owner of that company. Let's hope that I'm correct and that the checks the company are required to issue have lots of zeros in them. Or, although it takes way too much, way longer, that a jury who gets hold of it will understand that their only job in the world is to draw the number, to write down the number one, and then start writing zeros until their wrists cramp. Of course, Billable Rick, you know how this game is played, and you can probably already hear the, well, we were trying to protect our safety because, you know, the sirens was going off, and we know that they was going to be in more danger if they was out on the road trying to get home than they would have been right here in our state-of-the-art candle factory. You really can. You can hear that testimony, can't you, Billable?
Yeah, me too.
So, I've made it half a program, and I'm getting better all the time. And part of this is learning when to recognize that enough is enough, and I've reached the enough point. So I'll probably knock off for the evening, and like most of us, I will I'll be watching the committee hearing when it gavels in at 7 o'clock, and hopefully they'll bring the receipts and lay out all the details for their decision to vote contempt charges against Mark Meadows and make a referral to the full House. Then when the full House debates it, of course, we will watch the likes of Clanny Oakley, lying liar Lauren Bobblehead Boobert, stand up and shriek and groan and moan and grunt and hoot and bark about how unfair it is and how the executive privilege has to stay privileged, even though, as Jamie Gangel pointed out for CNN, Mark Meadows kind of blew that out of the water with his little attempt to make a fast buck on a book about it all. Oops. So thank you. We got $35 into the challenges. No, $45. Thanks to all of you who responded to that. Hopefully, maybe overnight, I don't know, maybe the remainder of those challenges will be met. It would be wonderful if they are. As to the Kentucky business lot, Lee in New York says, I keep hearing about the candle factory, but what about that Kentucky jelly factory? Oh, dear God. Kentucky jelly. Yeah, I never really understood the fascination people had with that Kentucky jelly. I don't think it's got much taste at all. It's kind of just gooey and never mind. Let it go. Let's not let the program get into the gutter. Even as I'm trying to wrap it up, you're awful, Lee. And you get a. I'm not sure if it's a gnur or a cowbell, but you get something for the Kentucky jelly factory. Oh God. So thank you to all of you who keep this program on the air. Thank you to our subscribers at Patreon and PayPal. Thank you to our a la carte contributors. Thank you to each and every one of you who share your precious finite time engaging in the program in whatever manner you so choose. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you, Sparky. Thank you, Steve. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thanks for the ancient Greeks wondering about climate change article, News Ninja Gene. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, HeadOn.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Cold River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, 20 plus years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia. This would be a great time to reach out to them, to your member of the House of Representatives. Ask them to please co-sponsor H.R. 2073, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act, the AHEC Act. It means the world to Appalachia. And, of course, please stay safe. Please get your booster, your vaccine if you haven't. I can't imagine there's anybody in our community that hasn't gotten their vaccine. Use your hand sanitizer, wash your hands, don't touch your face. Wear your mask everywhere you go. Maintain your social distance. And for God's sakes, if somebody comes burbling towards us, babbling about Jesus saved them from the tornado while completely oblivious to the people that Jesus apparently bumped off, well, avoid that person like the plague, because they are. And always, always, always. Gina, it's all for you. Later.